Leonard Cohen. Yeah. As a younger person, I guess. It's good, thank you. Thank you. So in our gathering this week, in this particular class, we're looking at the 10th Sufi thought, which begins with the words, "There is one path, the path of the annihilation of the false self into the real." And we're seeing if it's helpful to look at that, what that process, some of the contours of that process, you know, in terms of lived experience. And we've been using the lens of what the Sufis call fana baka, which is the process of change. It's the process of something dissolving or dropping away or being lost, so that something new can arise, a shell that breaks away in order for there to be a new birth, or training wheels that are no longer needed, or what is the process of an ending of a season and the beginning of a new. And we've seen that there's different ways that happens and different faces of fana and baka. And the ones that I thought it would be most pertinent to focus on in these days, not entirely, are the ones that are difficult. The ones that involve loss of different kinds or different kinds of suffering, because that's an aspect of life. And when we're experiencing that aspect of life, we all know that's where the rubber meets the road. It's where, if there's something to draw on in terms of spiritual teachings, we sure hope it's there, and we sure hope it's real. And it's also where the faith or principles or values that we've heard, admired, considered, are tested and become real to us. You know, it's easy to go around saying it's all good during sunshiny days. But what kind of process does a person go through that in the darkest of time they can actually feel and stand for that it's all good? That's a ripened station that seems to require struggle of different kinds, tests of different kinds. We're not talking, exploring this topic because the spiritual path is a path of despair, or just to have long faces. But in order for there to be the possibility of finding a well-being and a happiness that does not come and go, that requires a certain digging. I wondered that in my life for a long time. I read spiritual teachings that said our truest nature is blissful, is bliss, is happy. All the traditions, all the realized souls said that. And I thought, well, I don't think they're BSing me. I assume that it's true. You know, when I listen to someone like Hazrat Inayat Khan, I think He's saying what he has actually experienced and realized, and he has no other motive than to be helpful. So I take that as a starting place, and I think it must be true, but for the longest time, I could not verify that experience. And until I could verify it, I just took it as a hypothesis. But wanted to find out. That's what defines mysticism, find out from personal experience, from the inside. Others can point us, and that's very useful. And others can be exemplars. But we're not satisfied until we find out for ourselves, till something registers in us and we go, all right, now I know it's true. That usually requires being tested. Like, okay, is it true even here, even now? So I want to read you a few stories or passages that represent to me different stories about a possibility of beauty, a possibility of a certain kind of victory of the spirit that would not be possible without the dark. That if we remained in a transcendent, angelic world, there's a certain kind of beauty and victory that would not exist. So this first is just a letter that some of you might have heard this. Wendell Berry, do you know Wendell Berry?
Yes.
He wrote this to his granddaughters after they visited the Holocaust Museum. I'm feeling emotional because I have grandchildren, and they're so pure. So what happens when they encounter that kind of evil? What do you say? So here's the letter. Now you know the worst that we human beings have to know about ourselves. And I'm sorry. For I know that you will be afraid. To those of our bodies given without pity to be burned, I know there is no answer except loving one another. Even our enemies. And this is hard. But remember, when a man of war becomes a man of peace, he gives a light. Divine, though it is also human. When a man of peace is killed by a man of war, he gives a light. You do not have to walk in darkness. If you will have the courage for love, you may walk in light. It will be a light of those who have suffered for peace. And it will be your light. I think all of these express, here I am, doing the Zikr. Because this is the Zikr, it's one aspect. All of these perspectives show a view that, like, we can, a view we can share in, that if we come out of ground, a ground level perspective, and we can look across wider stretches of perspective, wider stretches of time. If we, perspectives that show more of the whole picture, the big picture, we see a vast harmony that at ground level, when we're embedded in it, it's harder to see that this had to occur in order for this to occur, or how things even out, or how something actually is born out of. So here's a letter from a book called Civil War Diaries. And this is a soldier in Camp Clark, Washington, in July 14th, 1861, fighting for the Union side of the war. And it's a letter to his wife before he's going off to battle. I think he's going to the Battle of Bull Run. It's a battlefield I visited when I was in college. My dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. Lest I shall not be able to write again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eye when I shall be no more. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I'm engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how strongly American civilization now leans on the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and sufferings of the revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this and to pay that debt to my country. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly on with these chains to the battlefield. The memories of the blissful moments I have spent with you come creeping over me, and I feel most grateful to God and to you to have enjoyed them for so long. It is hard for me to give them up and to burn to ashes the hope of our future years, when, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together. Do you see how, the letter's not over, but I just want to pause for a second. Do you see how at the moment of death, or the possibility of death becomes near, something of the preciousness of what we have comes into vivid relief? It is not until we are in touch with loss or that which can be taken away, quite often, that then we know its actual meaning. when God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and seen our sons grow up to honorable manhood around us. I know, but few and small claims upon divine providence, but something whispers to me, perhaps it is a wafted prayer, that I shall return to my loved ones unharmed. If I do not, my dear Sarah, never forget that I have loved you. And when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Isn't that beautiful? Forgive me many faults and many pains that I have caused you. How thoughtless and foolish I have often been. How gladly I would wash with my tears every spot upon your happiness. But if the dead can come back to this earth and flit around unseen around those they have loved, I shall always be near you. Always, always, as if there be a soft breeze upon your cheek, it shall be my breath. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone and wait for thee, for we shall meet again. This is written by Sullivan Ballou, who was killed a week later at the First Battle of the Bull Run. Just feel for a moment how your hearts respond to these passages. Would we wish that there were no battle, no death? Or is there something in us that can bow to the entire tapestry? This is the zikr. It doesn't end with death. It doesn't end with darkness. Tomorrow we'll work with the aspect of the zikr, which is baka, the rising, the rebirth. But the rebirth is not in the future. It's right here in our hearts. It's the birth of meaning, the birth of beauty. So I want to read one more story. This one's a killer. Some of you might know this story because I read it occasionally. This takes place in India, where the Dalai Lama was giving them empowerment, and people were coming from all over. So I'm just going to read parts of it. The Dalai Lama walked back outside the chapel after the ceremony. He turned to his right and he rounded the central tower of the temple. Just before he reached the temple gates, he abruptly changed course and he broke off to his right, approaching a large throng of Tibetans straining against the security personnel. With his bodyguard beside him, he headed for a young man seated on the ground next to an old woman with broad Mongolian features. The young man in his early 20s had a cane in his hand. Somehow, although his eyes were open, the Dalai Lama had surmised that the boy was blind. The Dalai Lama bent down, took the man's hand, and spoke to him in his deep baritone voice. He wanted to know where the blind man had come from, whether he had received any medical treatment. I marveled at the Dalai Lama's uncanny ability to pick out the disenfranchised, the disabled in giant crowds. I would later learn that the young man had come with his mother from the Machin area of Amdo, part of the Chinese province of Qinghai in northeast Tibet. He had lost his sight at the age of 15 when he suffered a severe concussion from a fall. An operation had restored his sight partially, but before long his blindness had returned. Over the years, his mother had desperately tried to find a cure for the son, taking him to major hospitals, where he had had another operation, was also treated with acupuncture and moxibustion. Nothing had worked. The man's optical nerves were badly damaged, and he was told he would never see again. When he heard that the Dalai Lama for the first time in 15 years would be performing this initiation in Bodh Gaya in early 2002, the son was determined to go. He wanted to be near the Dalai Lama to hear his teachings. Family and friends tried to dissuade him. The journey from northeastern Tibet to Nepal and India through the Himalayas would be dangerous, but he refused to listen. His mother sold all her jewelry and cattle and borrowed from relatives to scrape together enough money for the trip. Still, she held out hope that her son would be cured one day. Maybe they would get lucky in India at the birthplace of Buddhism. After a brief exchange with mother and son, the Dalai Lama turned to leave. The young man held on to his hands for a few moments, reluctant to let go. The Dalai Lama spoke to one of his aides. He wanted Dr. Dorji, one of his personal doctors and the director of the Delhi Hospital in Dharamsala, to examine the man to see if anything could be done. Then he left for the temple and walked back to the monastery. A couple of days after the Dalai Lama's encounter with the blind man in Bodh Gaya, I had dinner as usual in the small second floor dining room of the monastery. As I started on the soup, Dr. Dorji slid in beside me. He goes on to talk about their relationship. And I asked about the blind man from Tibet. I got the message from His Holiness, the doctor told me. But before I could go and check on the blind man, someone came to me with a piece of news. A young Tibetan, a monk from the monastery, wants to donate his eyes. I stopped slurping on the soup. I looked around me to see if others had heard what had just been said. But no one had taken notice. Yes, it's amazing, the Harvard-educated doctor said. I've never heard of such a thing. Eye donations, yes, but from dead people. Are they related? I asked after a long pause. They met on the pilgrimage. They knew each other for a few days. Have you met the young blind man? I asked. Yes, I went to the camp where the pilgrims are staying. There are 200 or 300 people living in canvas tents. They all managed to get through the Himalayas to Nepal, and then they bribed the border guards to let them into India, The blind man was in a tent together with 8 or 10 others. His mother cried the whole time I was there. Did you check his eyes? No, it was impossible. The light was poor and I didn't have my instruments with me. Did you tell him about the monk's offer? He knew about it already. Both men would need to be checked to see if they're compatible and whether the transplant was possible. I resumed eating my soup. The doctor stared at his bowl of noodles. He had eaten nothing. The blind man told me he had thought long and hard about the donation. Of course, he was tremendously moved, but he said in the end he would have to refuse. He had suffered tremendously over the years, and he simply couldn't bear the thought of another person going through that. So the face of Fana, the things we face in life, our crosses, our losses, our sacrifices. How do we be with them? What do we conclude? How do we guard the light? The faces of Fana take different forms. One form it takes for some of us is what we experience as spiritual limitation. Some of us might be on the path for decades and come to retreats and do our practices and perhaps not experience the things that we think we're supposed to experience or the things that are described. What do we do with that? How do we feel with that? Or we might have experiences that are so uplifting and then they go away. I'm just using this as one example. There's matters of health, there's matters of love, there's matters of finances. But let's just take this one possibility of hearing these beautiful vistas of spiritual states and perhaps not experiencing them. If you were a guide and someone came to you and said that, they've been doing their practices diligently for 25 years and yet they can't concentrate, or God's not real, it's just words when they pray. This is not unusual, too unusual. What would you say? So, when we do the zikr and we bow to what is. There's a kind of surrender that is you might say, is life-giving, and there's the kind that is not. One is a kind of resignation, like, oh, well, life didn't turn out so well. And this is the best we can expect. But there's another kind of surrender that actually resurrects out of the world of limitation something enduring, something sacred. Well, what that might that be if a person has practiced for decades and well, one thing, oftentimes people have a view that they, quote, haven't gotten anywhere, and it's not true. And that is one of the reasons why one is, we're taught to learn to cultivate gratitude, because there's a tendency to think about what we don't have and not what is here and all the blessings that are here. So a person might have this idea, well, I'm not experiencing, you know, glorious lights and lots of bells and whistles and et cetera, et cetera. But if you start actually investigating more carefully, you will see the way their soul has ripened. There's something else, another aspect, when we do the zikr, we're cultivating this knowledge that my life does not belong to me, that I show up, and what occurs, what is experienced in this location is what is given. It's extremely intimate and personal, and simultaneously it doesn't belong to me, and it's not my business what happens. And that is a kind of correction of our perspective that brings a kind of beautiful, sweet freedom. What may be. There's another answer, which I think is part of what comes out of these stories. I see this quite often with sincere seekers. A person might be sitting there thinking, I don't have these great experiences, and they're sitting there year after year. And maybe somewhere else somebody's having these beautiful experiences. Readily. Is that what the spiritual path is about, having experiences? The person who's struggling to concentrate for 30 years, or who's saying the prayers and doesn't feel the presence of Moses, may not realize how sweet they're becoming. They might not realize what becomes of a human being who is that faithful, that persevering. Who on which report card are we going to say is the successful one? Quite often, the people who have never known the dark and limitation are the people who turn into monsters. It's just one victory after another. If only those people could see that their faithfulness in the face of, quote, failure is ripening a certain kind of consciousness, a certain kind of human possibility. is Jesus coming into Jerusalem on the donkey? In a humble guise. So perhaps we can feel in these stories, in these examples, something of the heart of surrender, of the aspect of zikr, which is the bowing. Softly laying our hands, ourselves in the hands of our Creator and Sustainer. Resting comfortable. In harmony. With what is. I don't know if any of you saw the bowl of sake this morning. The headline was something like, what did it say? It said something about most people rejoice at the joy and ecstasy of life and they crash in the pain and failure of life, but the wise just looks at it and says, this is all the nature of life. So, in keeping with the structure that we've been doing in these days, I'd like to give you an opportunity, if you would like, to contemplate this theme with some of your friends. And if you'd rather do this just alone and in silence, you can do that, or in a journal. If there's something nice about speaking together. And we'll explore this theme. I'll give you some words for a few minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll join in the zikr together with a particular emphasis on the bowing aspect of the zikr. Well, I had written down the question. I can't find, but the question is, along these lines, to contemplate. Let me see if I can find the question. Sometimes the words are important. What is your experience of the sanctity of suffering? Of the sanctity of suffering. Of suffering made holy. What is your experience of that? Does the question make sense?
Can you say it again?
What is your experience of the sanctity of suffering? Of suffering made holy? Okay. So we'll take, about 4 or 5 minutes each. For those of you who haven't been here before, these are monologues. If you're in a group of three, which I is ideal, one person talks at a time and the other people are silent witnesses. And then I'll call time and the next person speak and then the next person. Okay, we'll see you in about 15 minutes. So what?
I just want to check out the
Yeah, it's working. Excuse me, I just want to say one more thing about this practice. Hatha Nayakam says there are certain things that are so sacred, so precious, that one should only discuss them with one's teacher or in spiritual friendship. And I think it's good to be aware that as we share in sacred contemplation like this, it is the creation of the universal, of the bonds of spiritual friendship, where our hearts feel that the unity of human experience together. So we're building something here. We're not just talking. And I think you know that. Thank you.